This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today, I'm talking to Peter Costanzo, who is the digital publishing manager and it's a complicated title. I'm not going to even try to remember it all, for the Associated Press, which is, we will refer to as AP. And, you know, Peter and I have known each other for a long time. We've been kind of traveling upstream together for a while in the digital world. And I thought it would be a good chance for a good time for us to catch up. We did talk once a few years ago about what was going on then. Times have changed. So we're going to see if we can navigate the current murkiness of digital publishing. How are you, Peter?
I'm very good, David. Thank you for having me.
Very good to do this. And it's nice to talk to you again.
Yes, you're right.
Even though neither of us can remember how long it's been, nor what we've done in the intervening years.
I think it's been at least 5 years. So that's a good window of time.
That's good. Yeah. Things have really changed. Yeah. So you've been involved in digital publishing and marketing for probably as long as almost anybody.
Yeah. Easily 20 years.
Right. Which... That puts you in advance, you know, ahead of the curve,
yeah,
shall we say.
So to speak.
So a lot of, you've done digital publishing, you know, you've actually created digital books in many different forms and formats. You know, you've worked at Perseus, F&W, NBC, where you started a digital publishing business.
Right.
And now AP. So maybe just you could talk a little bit about what you're doing at the AP, which... maybe people would be interested in, because it's not, you know, it's not a book publishing entity, but right. It's publishing.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because the AP actually has, in a way, been in the book business for probably probably a good 50 to 60 years. I mean, they actually used to publish their own books about various topics that they were passionate about. And it's really fascinating because we have a whole archive department, and I work with these terrific archivists who, you know, every so often they'll pull out these projects that were done by the AP many, many years ago, and they were published for various reasons. They were either internally created to be distributed to all their members, all the newspapers.
And just to be clear for people who may not know the history of AP, it's a membership organization created by newspapers.
That's correct. It's a consortium of newspapers, and it was founded in 1846, and we're celebrating our 170th year. So it's been around for a long time. And more recently, you know, they've dipped their toe in publishing books. But one of the things that they've always been involved in is they're one of the go-to companies that book publishers go to for photographs and historical content and artifacts. So, you know, whether it's about the Vietnam War or whatever it might be, the AP is a constant source of material.
Now, do publishers send people to you to do research, or do they call you, call AP up and say, this is what we're working on, can your people find us material?
Right. It's a combination. You know, depending on the level of participation by the AP, sometimes these projects are just providing licensed content. And at that point, you know, people are obviously paying for the content. And so in a way, they're paying for the labor that it takes to find it. But if it's viewed as a project where it'll say by the editors of the Associated Press or something like that, there could be some real involvement by the AP that, you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, is almost viewed as voluntary to assemble that information. And it's kind of amazing, the people there. They're legacy people who have basically all this knowledge in their head. I mean, naturally, they have computers at their fingertips, and they can, you know, look in files. But it's incredible how much, when you just talk to them about what might be in the archives, that they just know. So I have the pleasure now of working with a number of those people on the book projects that I put together for AP. And, you know, it's been a combination of trying projects that were, you know, the assemblage of reporting from over the years about a particular topic. It's been an effort of identifying reporters who were at very pivotal moments in history, who are still with us, who can write and have a story to tell. And it's been a combination of experiments where we're looking at projects that'll be digital solely and will be probably more pictorial in nature, so more photographic with very minimal amount of text. And so that's really been my focus. Frankly, the projects that were the grouping of reports haven't really performed very well. And so I'm really putting my focus more on the talent of some of the incredible reporters from over the years. And also my next wave of focus for the second half of this year, and particularly for 2017, is going to be digital projects that are sponsored by corporations. So we have a number of those that I'm working on right now, because as you know, David, we've been in this business a long time, and we know that the margins on ebooks in particular, and even print on demand, are very low.
They're Well, actually, that's big. One of the things I was thinking about when we before we got together to ask you about, because, you know, we've talked a lot over the years, you and I and others, about ebooks taking better advantage of what ebooks allow, enable, afford in terms of content, rather than strictly seeing them as the digital equivalent and maybe a poor equivalent of a printed book in some respects. In other words, you know, ebooks have advantages over print, but they also have disadvantages in comparison to print. And it feels like some of the advantages have been under-exploited, underused, underappreciated, so that in the commercial world, they simply have not been practical to do.
Right.
And, you know, these are the things that, you know, many people have called, I hate this term, enhanced book, enhanced ebook, because it doesn't really properly communicate the possibilities. Mm. But for lack of a better term, and because other people use it, let's supposing, and we've, you know, some of your experiences directly apropos at NBC, mm-hmm. as I recollect,
right.
you had tremendous success mm-hmm. with ebooks that engaged readers using video and other content, moving parts, let's call them.
Right, but let's define success. We had tremendous success reaching audiences with projects that were interactive, mm-hmm. if we want to use that word, that featured video, audio, photographs that were, you know, presented in slideshows, and other
social media connection,
social media integration, and other features that were literally programmed widgets that would allow you to do all kinds of cool stuff that in an Apple universe was possible. And we reached a tremendous amount of people because, number one, the majority of those projects were free to the public.
Right, and connected to an existing television show that had a large audience.
Or movie.
So the, so the ebook in that case was looked at and actually behaved as an adjunct to another medium.
Yes.
What I guess the reason I bring that up, what it proves is that people are engaged and interested in that form of content in a circumstance where they didn't have to pay for it.
Yes.
But you prove the use case.
Yeah.
Even though you give it to them for free, mm-hmm. they actually use it.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes integral to their experience of appreciating and being involved in a television show or a film.
Yeah, I think the other aspect, and you and I have talked about this privately, and I've written about it publicly, that I think is key here is until Amazon decides that perhaps enhanced ebooks or ebooks with interactivity would be a great investment for them as a way to attract people to buy the Kindle Fire tablet. Until Amazon embraces those types of projects, unfortunately, even though we proved out at NBC that you could reach 500,000 people with an enhanced ebook and really effectively promote either a TV show or a movie or even a particular topic, it was still limited, even though that's a big number.
Right, because you're not reaching the universe of Amazon Kindle-related readers.
Which we know is the majority of the ebook universe. So even though within a very focused effort, you could easily reach a lot of people, it's really more about the sustainability of those kinds of efforts. And unfortunately for publishers, I just think that it became so obvious that it was just way too challenging to produce those kinds of projects and expect to make any real return on investment.
Well, no, I think it's I think it's proven that you can't.
Completely proven.
It's a dead issue in the transactional space.
Right.
But because you brought up sponsored projects in relation to AP, that made me – I mean, that's sort of the segue, which is, you know, the publishing is – we think of publishing in a transactional model because that's what publishing has been. Produce a book and sell the book. There are other models. You know, sponsored books, sponsored ebooks, sponsored projects of all kinds can be viable for a publisher where because the book has value in a context that's not defined by the transaction, it's possible to do it economically.
Yeah, and I think the sponsored model, though, only makes sense if you have one brand that's fairly well known or very well known speaking to another brand that's well known. So when you're an NBC and you have this incredible platform to promote, you can go to a Citigroup, you can go to a Bank of America or whoever it might be, and they're willing to play along and support a project that they care about as well because they know that NBC or whoever that brand entity is that's recognizable has the platform to reach a tremendous amount of people. I think even for publishers who might be able to entertain the idea of a sponsored project, they really don't have the same level of a platform because they don't have the same name recognition for the average person. So not that they can't reach people, but they can't necessarily reach people in mass numbers that make it worth another brand that's well known to participate. Now, the AP is not certainly at the level of an NBC as far as popularity.
Right.
You know, people hear,
it's not a consumer brand.
It's not. I mean, people hear the Associated Press or they hear AP when they listen to NPR or even, you know, their regular news station or whatever it might be, even in sports, right? You'll see, you know, sports scores brought to you by the AP.
Right.
And people see it everywhere. So there is an opportunity to remind people that, okay, this is the type of content that comes from the AP and here it is coming to you in book form. And so some of the books that we've published that do have price tags on them that have been, you know, somewhat modestly successful are incredible memoirs written by reporters who were, like I said earlier, at these pivotal moments like the fall of Saigon, for example, during the Vietnam War, or who were paid witness to many of the incredible moments during the civil rights era in the 60s, who were at these moments that were firsthand and can tell the story about how they got that incredible photograph or how they were in, for example, this one particular reporter I'm thinking of, this woman named Katherine Johnson. She was the only reporter who had a real personal relationship with the King family, the Martin Luther King family, and was the only reporter allowed in the King household the night of his assassination. So imagine that story, that perspective, being able to tell that story. Those are projects that I'm very proud to be involved in, and we're making those available as ebooks, as print on demand, so that depending on what we think the demographic is, who the audience is, we do make these books available as print. But I have to say that for me personally, even though I have access at the AP to terrific video and audio and those types of elements, I have not had the desire, at least not yet, to try and put together the same kind of interactive projects I did at NBC or even at Perseus and F&W coming from the AP. I've completely shifted my focus and decided that I would much rather reach as many people as possible. And let's face it, that's been through the Kindle platform, and create reading products that are just going to be as distributed as wide and far as possible, so that no matter what kind of device people look at it on, they're able to look at it and enjoy it and have the exact same experience that some other device has.
So that leads me to another questioning, or another area of questioning that you could maybe address. You know, I'm sure, I know you're familiar with the concepts of books and browsers, you know, the kind of anti-device movement. And not necessarily, it's not like a movement of people saying this is the way we should go, but there is a lot of interest in, and I think a lot of people are actually reading outside of devices, or outside of the e-reader platforms, still on devices maybe, but, you know, this sort of browser-driven HTML5. Do you see that as having, do you think that's going to evolve and become meaningful in the marketplace, even though it kind of, because it does go around the existing distribution channels, which is, you know, both, I mean, that's good and bad. Right. You know, there are millions of people who are connected into the Kindle ecosystem, millions of people, maybe other millions of people, but fewer connected to Kobo, Nook, Google Play, various other devices and reading platforms. When you take the book or the reading experience outside of those, you do engage then in the broader tool set and the broader and the expectations of readers too are different. You know, I think that defined by the platforms that you are on kind of give you cues about what to expect.
Right.
So on Kindles, you expect a clean reading experience. I think what you've talked about earlier kind of confirms that readers like type on the white page, mm-hmm. and that's what they're going to get from a Kindle, even though the Fire exists, and the Fire is more probably bought by people who are combining multi-use experiences. You know, they'll use it for video games or watching television, and they occasionally would read. But the pure reading is done on the Kindle device. It's kind of, okay, I just don't want any, just don't confuse me. Right. I want to read.
And from what I understand, and I don't have any like official confirmation about this, but my understanding is that Amazon made a conscious decision to deliver that kind of experience, even though they have a tablet. They don't want to have any difference in experience if I'm on my Kindle Paperwhite or if I'm on my Kindle Fire. Yes, you can. If you look around, you can find ebooks that have video and all that, but they're not pushing it. If you go to their site,
right,
you do not see any promotions for it. And I used to think, gee, you know, that's awfully not backwards necessarily, but I thought it was awfully timid in embracing what's possible, like you were saying earlier, like thinking in terms of, hey, this is digital. Let's take advantage of everything digital has to offer. But when I had the experience of publishing the Grimm Project, for example, for NBC, using iBooks Author, Apple's proprietary format, and that can only be experienced on an iPad, it was amazing how many Apple users of iPhones and iPods went to the iBooks store to complain about the fact that they could not look at that book project on their smaller device. They couldn't understand it. And they didn't blame Apple. They blamed us at NBC. And, you know,
why didn't you make this? Why right. didn't you build this for the iPhone?
Right. Not knowing
not recognizing, because Apple doesn't really make a big point of it,
yeah.
that And I actually, that's something that you can forget, you know, like, oh, wait, you mean I can't read this on my iPhone?
Right. And that's millions of other people
yeah.
that all they hear is go to the iBookstore if they have the app, right? And so they're thinking, well, I've got the iBookstore app on my iPhone. Why can't I look at that product on my iPhone? Oh, Jesus, you're telling me I have to go buy an iPad if I don't own one so I can look at that. And it was astounding at the level of frustration that was being expressed. And I have to admit, at that moment, I got it. I understood why Amazon made the decision they made. And I started to come around to look at this in a different way. It doesn't mean I don't believe in interactive ebooks. I still believe in the potential of them. But I really do believe that it will, again, have to be Amazon, most likely, that leads that charge. When they decide that they want to let their readers have that experience their way, they will either produce them themselves and, you know, look at it as, like I said, a loss leader, just an attractive reason to say, you can experience this on our Kindle Fire tablet, not just on the iPad. And they'll probably, maybe they will figure out a way that you could also look at it through their app on any device, who knows. But I think until they do, you won't see them go down that path. And like I said, I get it now. I don't push it.
So do you think that means that in the kind of ecosystem of books, right now we have, let's say, between most books are probably 15 to 25% of sales would be digital. You know, I mean, it's fairly steady at this point. You know, certain types of books more, like, as you know, romance and mystery, I think the rate of pickup or take up from ebooks is higher. But overall, most publishers seem to be in that 15 to 30% range.
Right.
And that seems fairly stable now. What I thought of when you said, you know, it would be up to Amazon to change, to open things up in a different direction. So two questions arise. One, is there any incentive for them to do that? You know, based on what we know of their situation, it may not be true. If readers are not clamoring for a reading experience that's different from what they have, then there's really no reason to deliver it. We've sort of had some evidence that if you deliver it, they don't come, even though we know that evidence is not totally clear because there is no Amazon capability, really. But then the second part is sort of, does that mean that Amazon's reading experience and ecosystem is kind of primed for disruption? You know, is there somebody out there that we don't know about, you know, some entrepreneur, somebody thinking, gee, you know, this is really kind of a box, you know, where it's a limited box. Maybe I can blow it up.
I thought that was going to be Google way back when Google got into the book business and decided they were going to be a retailer and not just a company that scanned books and made them available for free or to come up in search. And I wrote about that extensively in a blog that I used to write many years ago. I said, okay, you know, because Google is a browser-based reading experience. So they were supposed to be the platform that you could read anywhere and just log in once, right? One login, that's their thing. And so no matter where you are, at a desktop, on your cell phone, whatever, you can log in and read.
And they know where you – what I am always amazed by is that if I go from my phone to my computer on Chrome, it – whatever I looked at on my phone is now in my browsing history on my computer. I'm thinking, wait a minute, that's so weird.
Yeah, and it's cool. And
it is.
And so I thought Google was going to be the innovative company that maybe could deliver browser-based interactive experiences. And again, they did not, right? They had no seemingly had no interest in that. And I think what happens is time and time again, people with real ambitious ideas come to the book business and they think, we're going to reinvent this. We're going to make this amazing. We're going to deliver something that people don't even realize they need, and it's going to be incredible. But then when people start to realize how small the margins are in the book business, they get out, right? Look at Google. They were supposed to be the company that was going to help the independent stores. have ebooks, have ebook capability,
right?
Right, and they left. They basically,
I know they bailed.
They
actually.
Bailed.
They
right?
bailed, leaving the independent stores holding the bag.
Exactly,
after convincing them
right.
we're here to save you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. They bailed because they realized there's no traffic level that they're used to. It doesn't meet their
yeah.
criteria of what to them makes sense to be involved in. I mean, even, you know, when Steve Jobs famously said, you know, people don't read anymore, naturally he didn't mean nobody reads anymore. He just meant the majority of people.
Well, it was like a Yogi Berra line.
You yeah,
know?
Exactly. Right. But I mean, he just meant the majority of people, you know, reading books is not top of mind for most
right.
people. Most people view it as a luxury, right? I mean, even you and I, who consider ourselves in this industry, if I didn't have my hour commute on my train every day, I would not read nearly as much as I do. That commute gives me the solitude to be able to say, okay, I'm going to read at my leisure because I have an hour to do so. Most people don't have that opportunity. So so really that's what he meant. And that's why even to this day, I think we have not seen a major effort by Apple to promote. When have you seen one TV commercial beyond maybe at the very beginning when they kind of showed you Winnie the Pooh on an iPad that had a little bit of it, of, you know, interactivity?
Well, they didn't even put the iBookstore in, you know, it wasn't even preloaded until recently, you know, the
yeah.
last year and a half or so.
Well, I think it was more than that, but you're right, though. But here's the bigger problem that happened with the iBookstore. When they launched, they didn't have the biggest publisher on the app when it launched for availability of titles that almost everybody knew at the time, and that was Random House.
Right.
Okay, they didn't have The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and all these major bestsellers.
Well, true, but iTunes didn't have The Beatles either. So you could argue that, I mean, they had a lot.
They had a lot, but if you look at the bestseller list, Random House dominates
yeah.
that bestseller so much.
That's true. That made the iBookstore that much less attractive.
It certainly did, because
yeah.
you would say, okay, I want to buy this book. I'll check out the iBookstore, see if I can get it there,
right.
see if I can even get it at a better price, whatever. And it wasn't there at all, right?
Right.
So, I mean, when Colin McCann won the National Book Award for Let the Great World Spin, I think that was the one that he won for, you couldn't get it at the iBookstore because that was a Random House title at the time. It just wasn't there. So to my mind, they launched at a handicap, and I think that they had a hard time recovering from that, and they've made no real incredible effort to shine a light on the iBookstore to the average consumer and say, here's the difference. If you come here, here's what you'll be able to do. And you and I, who've tried to produce these kinds of products, the interactive products, you know, we sit there and we scratch our heads and we think, why not? Why haven't they, you know, said, look at the incredible things you can do in with our version of digital books that you cannot do anywhere else? And so that remains, to me, still a big question mark.
Yeah. Well,
and I think it only boils down to, it has to boil down that they say, you know, there just aren't enough numbers there
right.
financially.
Well, the input side is expensive and the output side is limited. So it looks like a bad bet. You know, not enough people buy books is
right.
what you're saying,
right.
you know, that it's a small business and it's not going to get bigger even if ebooks are counted. The business, I mean, that was the other funny thing about, I don't think anybody knows exactly, but ebooks may have grown the business a bit, but they didn't grow the business a lot.
Right.
So that the book business is not significantly bigger as the result of a digital innovation. Now, you could say that's actually better than the record business, which is a lot smaller
mm-hmm.
than it used to be
mm-hmm.
by a major factor. So while the book business didn't grow, it also wasn't hollowed out at the core.
Right. And also, let's face it, the book business benefited from what the music business went through. You know,
yes.
the publishing industry had the hindsight of what happened in the music world and really did fight hard to, you know, participate in innovation and yet try and hold on to their core publishing program, which is print books.
Benefit significantly from the fact that streaming a book is not as meaningful as streaming music, so that, you know, you can listen to music anytime, any place, anywhere now. The plethora of music online is just ridiculous. There's no reason to ever buy another CD, you know, or a digital, you know, why even bother paying for digital downloads when there's so much free music out there? Not literally free, but, you know, you can subscribe to any number of streaming services for a lot less money than you would spend in a year to buy in the old days to buy CDs, records, or whatever. Right. With books, it's not the same. There isn't, in fact, no one has made a go really of a subscription service that would be the equivalent of any of the streaming services either.
Right. I mean, even Kindle Unlimited, again, I think that for Amazon, that's probably just a loss leader. It's a convenient thing. And the area where I think Kindle has really decided that they were going to try and match what we see happening in other industries, like, for example, DVDs, where you buy the latest Pixar movie, and there might be on that DVD a digital file that you can download, and then you can watch it on your device or whatever. Kindle Match is kind of doing that, right? They're saying if you want to buy this print book, you could get the ebook at the same time, either for $2.99 more or $1.99, or sometimes for free, depending on what the publisher wants to do. And that makes total sense to me. That's the world we live in now. People want whatever product they're consuming, they want it whatever way they want to be able to conveniently access it, whether they have it at home waiting for them when they crawl into bed and they snuggle up with their physical book, that's fine. But if they're about to get on a plane, they want to be able to look at the same book on their Kindle. And what they don't want is to think, wait a minute, I have to rebuy that book in essence for $9.99 or $12.99 digitally, even though I have it sitting at home. And I just bought it for $24 or $12, whatever it was. And that makes sense. This idea that you're going to, the bulk of your money might go towards the purchase of the print version. And for a little bit more, here's the digital version.
Yeah, I've been continually surprised that more publishers have not participated in that.
Well, because I think it's a fear. They think that it's going to completely erode, right, you know, the digital side of the business. And whereas I think you could argue that it makes the print side of the business more attractive if I know I'm going to get this digital version for just not much more money.
No, I agree. I think if you buy the print book, getting the ebook for free is
For 99 cents.
Or even for an add-on amount of money. Yeah. I don't see how that could be there's no conquest there that I can think of, because I don't see too many consumers buying a print book and then going out and buying the digital equivalent. I think people buy one instance of a book. Right. Now they may buy the ebook, and that's again what we've seen is that, you know, because of the market not going toward really low priced ebooks, the print business has in fact been protected. You know, if ebooks were less expensive, you might see fewer print books sold, and then you would get into the downward spiral that most publishers would be afraid of, and that is too few books printed means your unit cost is way high, which means you can't even maintain your pricing margins at, you know, in the print version, while meanwhile you're not selling enough more digital books to make up for the erosion of print sales. So right. That trap has been avoided. And we don't know whether there's no way to prove whether that's the right way to go or not.
Right. And so the question is, if you're making your ebook available for a much less price if someone buys a print book, the question is there a fear by publishers that then that makes their $12.99 ebook look devalued at that moment? And is that why more publishers aren't participating? But here's the thing, like you mentioned a moment ago, why would anybody buy a CD? I actually, when I want to really own an album, I do buy the CD. And what's really terrific to my mind, what Amazon does is I'll buy the latest Willie Nelson CD or whatever it is, and instantly they allow me to download it.
Right.
To my,
I know, you get, in fact, there they've created the equivalency. If you buy the physical good, you get the digital equivalent for free.
Exactly.
And in fact, they went back into our history of buying.
Exactly. And they gave me everything.
They gave you all of it.
Now, that's because you were a Prime customer, yes. And I'm a Prime customer.
Yes.
And so they basically take the American Express attitude, I guess, if you're a member of this club, here are the benefits. And one of the benefits, if you're a music fan, you buy the CD, you're going to get the digital copy right then and there, and you can start listening to it immediately.
Right.
Even though I know the CD is coming in 2 days, and I personally have a comfort knowing that I have the physical version. I like having it because I've had the experience of my entire iTunes library crashing or disappearing, you know, before the cloud. And that's an unsettling feeling. You know, I teach a course at NYU about new media technology and whatnot. And I'm always kind of reminding students that digital's terrific. Obviously, that's my world. But that there's a lot to be said for having archived physical artifacts at our fingertips as well. Because if everything eventually becomes just digital, first of all, from a civilization standpoint, you want to talk about one civilization being able to wipe out the culture of another with just by hitting a delete button as opposed to physically trying to wipe them out. Whereas no matter what in history, even though there have been civilizations wiped out, there's always remnants. There are always physical remnants left behind that have allowed us to get some idea about that culture that did exist at one time. But digitally, it's really easy to wipe things
out. Well, and of course, then the thing that you would worry about also is the ability to retain the technological, like, what if, we've seen floppy disks go away. We've seen tape drives disappear.
Right.
You know, you have all this media that you have no ability to read.
How many of us have home videos, that we filmed on a camcorder? How many of us have tapes and tapes and tapes and tapes of all these family home videos that we just haven't necessarily found the time to transfer them to the next technology to keep preserving them? So you have to keep up with this stuff. And unless you can bring it to a service that does it for you, it's a tremendous amount digital. And that's, I think that's the thing that has been always poorly communicated to the average consumer, is that digital ain't easy, right? Digital is actually hard. Just as much effort goes into producing digital products in many ways as can be done for a physical product. And but somehow the mentality has come across that, well, this is digital, so it was almost magic to create, and it shouldn't cost a lot. It should just cost a little bit of money.
Well, but that's because we associate the value with the physical object. And when there's no physical object, we think that the cost and value equation is different. And that doesn't take into account, and in a way you can't blame a consumer for this, for not understanding the relationship between the content and the medium. And so, and it is true, I think, that digital technologies have this kind of amazing ability to brainwash us on some level and to replace value with something else. We've seen that with where people's jobs are disappear because of automation. It's pretty quick before it doesn't take long before people forget that those jobs were done by real human beings, and that it appears to be magical.
It's interesting because if you remember, when I produced that GFK 50 Days product for Perseus back in 2010, 2011, that was an app, right? Because the iBookstore didn't exist yet. And there was a physical book, but this app was kind of an offshoot concept based on the physical version. And I spent hours and hours, and my colleague at the time, Jamie Calloway, as well, we spent hours reviewing video of JFK and Jackie, and the amount of labor that went into producing that app and the programming that went into making that app at the time. And we did that with the now defunct Vuk company. if you try to explain to people how much time and effort went into it, it sounds like you're whining, right? But we couldn't price that thing very high. We couldn't price it more than $4.99 or $6.99. But what's crazy, and this is what's really interesting about the work I'm doing at the AP, is if you were to just license the video that appeared in that app, which was a tremendous amount of video. It's like 50 different video clips appeared in that app. If you were, say, Ken Burns, and you came to license that that grouping of video for a documentary, you would have paid a tremendous amount of money for the rights to even have that video, right?
Right, and then here people got it for almost nothing.
Right, here it's delivered in this app, and they're looking at these clips, and they're getting it for this incredibly low price, about the price of a tall latte at Starbucks. And at the AP, what's really very attractive for me is having access to the tremendous photography that goes back, you know, to the 1800s. Any book project that we work on features just these terrific photographs. And I try to be mindful in mining the archives so that we're not picking the same photograph you see over and over and over again. I really try to bring my own personal editorial sensibilities to it and try to present images that people don't see every day tied to a particular topic. There are some images you can't avoid. They're iconic. People want to see them. They want to see it in that project. But what's great is to have that access to the archives and be able to bookend, if you will, photographs that people are used to seeing with photographs that they're not. And the only problem there, and you were talking about this earlier as far as the difference between physical and digital, is that you are limited to a degree with the digital because you don't want to create a file that's obviously so huge. So you are only putting in a certain amount of photos. So you have to be very selective. I'm a big fan of just putting in photo galleries in a digital product. I don't really like to interrupt the text. I don't like trying to put a photo exactly where you think it should appear within the body of the text, because we know that once somebody starts enlarging or decreasing the font size on their device, all hell can break loose as far as the formatting. So you could spend all this time, you know, really trying to format an ebook. It looks so beautiful, and it would look beautiful if it just stays that way, right? The moment people start changing things.
Or just moving it on a different, like if you watch, look at it on an iPad and it looks perfect.
Right.
But then I open it on my computer screen.
Totally different.
Doesn't look right.
Right. Totally different. And you can get it to look right, but you have to spend a lot of time and effort.
And the automatic default is something's wrong. Not exactly. If I just changed it, it would be right.
Right, exactly. So it's, you know, talk about challenging. Talk about the amount of effort and labor that goes into trying to make this digital file look consistent across all these different platforms. I mean, that's a whole other conversation right there. But you know, the thing is, we've allowed, because we think that the idea of freedom in an ebook is a good thing, we've allowed people this incredible spectrum of choices as far as the font and, you know, nighttime viewing and, you know, the sepia and all this stuff. Personally, I think that was probably not a good way to go. I think very early on, there literally should have been like three options, small, medium, large, as far as font. And basically, that would have given publishers in the digital space an opportunity to just focus on three different views and how it would have come across if people chose either one of those views. But this idea that you can go this far-reaching, huge, I mean, let's face it, I don't care how blind you are or whatever, nobody's going to choose that ridiculous, ridiculous, ridiculous large font where it's literally almost one letter on the screen. But the fact that you can do that forces publishers to have to think about what happens if somebody does choose that option.
Well, and it kind of actually, and I've thought about this, I know book designers have, it kind of flies in the face of, you know, what amounts to 600 years of learned book design, you know, about the way that humans interact with a page,
right?
And really undermines a lot of what was learned.
That's right. And also, even the idea of literally reading in a linear fashion and going from left to right, you know, we've seen many interactive projects in particular that try to, like, force people to experience reading in a different way.
Yeah,
right?
It doesn't work.
Where you would dive in here or do this or do that and open this and go up, go down. And it failed. And we even see that being problematic in the magazine world, right? When Wired magazine and others try to use the Adobe platform and try and introduce a different way of accessing the content, people just really didn't enjoy it. They didn't mind still reading, flipping through pages digitally. They just maybe wanted to see some interactivity with pop-ups and, you know, slideshows and things like that. But this roller coaster ride that companies were trying to take people through digitally, it didn't work. And it also didn't work because Wired had their way and Esquire had their way, and everyone had a different way for you to read their digital magazine. And, you know, nobody was going to win that. That's like Beta and VHS all over again.
Or worse, because it's atomizing an experience that people expect to be common and predictable.
Exactly. So I think that, you know, still presenting, even when I did the highly interactive products for NBC, I still presented the experience that I navigated the reader through in a linear way. You were not forced, but you were invited to experience something. But it was always, here's the next thing for you to experience.
Right.
And there were, you know, little things that would happen on a page, but you didn't lose your place. You didn't have suddenly a confusion as to where you were in the project. And that's key, in my opinion, for people feeling like they're knowing where they are within the content itself.
So let me ask you one more question. And that is, you mentioned teaching this class at NYU.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. Now, that's the publishing program there.
It is, the Master's of Science publishing
so
program.
So do you find, in your experience of working with those kids, or young people, because, you know, they can be different ages, but there are people getting their master's in publishing. What's your sense of their understanding as they are a different generation than the technology people who have built the ebook business that we know? This is a generation that's grown up in a digital world. And of course, they love books and they probably love print books because they want to be in the publishing business. So I'm not assuming anything about them, but I'm just curious because their contextual basis is so different from mine and yours.
Yeah.
What do you learn from them?
It was interesting. When I was teaching the graduate program, which was usually a class of 16 students, and they averaged age usually 21 through 24, around that age group. Mainly, though, the medium age was about 22, 23. I would always ask at the beginning, how many of you read only digitally? How many read physically, whatever? And it was always astounding how many of the students raised their hand that they still read physical books, they still read physical magazines, they preferred physical textbooks, which was a major thing for them. Where they experience content digitally is, and when you say it, it makes total sense, socially, right? Through Facebook, through Instagram, through Snapchat, whatever it is, that's where they get the digital content. Yeah, they'll look at the New York Times digitally for an article, whatever, but they don't necessarily have any aversion to sitting with the physical version of the New York Times. And I think that what we're seeing is, this is the generation, and we'll see it more, that is perfectly comfortable living in both worlds. They have their digital experiences for whatever makes sense, and they still enjoy things physically, right? And I've always been an advocate for that from the very beginning. When I was an online marketing person, you know, 15 years ago, anytime I was on a panel or something like that, I would always kind of bristle a little bit when someone else on a panel would talk about how all physical stuff's going away and, you know, all that. And when it came to publicity, that online marketing was where it's at. Honestly, I always described the opportunity of online marketing as an echo of the physical. I always thought of it as an incredible opportunity that wasn't there before, because if an author now appeared on a radio program, say on NPR, instead of saying, hey, did you hear, that author on Terry Gross? And if you missed it, you missed it.
Right.
Now, obviously, you have this ability to put it on all these different platforms and get it out there, and whether it's their own website, within an app, through Facebook or whatever other channel, the physical lives on through the digital. But the digital certainly doesn't replace, in many instances, the physical. I still believe that when it comes to publicity and marketing, that you could have a magical moment online, a viral moment, or whatever it is. And when those moments happen, it's terrific. That can really promote a book, if we're thinking in terms of books only. But there's still nothing like getting an author on a highly listened radio program, a TV show like the Today Show, or whatever it might be. But it's the combination of getting that author on a platform that people are so comfortable and familiar with, and then using the online platforms as a way to make it live on, live on, live on. And for me, the best example of that was when we had the skinny bitch phenomenon at Perseus, right? Where getting those authors on the Today Show was a huge thing, but me also shooting videos of them and getting videos that we controlled, where we controlled the conversation, because everyone wanted to paint those two women as monsters because of what that book was. It was filled with foul language, and it was, you know, very descriptive when it came to animal cruelty and whatnot. I had the opportunity online to show them as real people and to show that they were smart, engaged women who really cared and were passionate. We used podcasts. We used their website, of course, which was the platform for everything. That was the hub. And anything that happened in the physical world, we could re-promote there. But we were also able to generate our own opportunities. So I still think that that is true to this day. When I'm astounded when I go to Book Expo, and there'll be a panel of online marketers, quote unquote, or digital marketers, and they're asked, you know, how do you promote? They're still talking about using third-party companies, whether it's Book Hub or whatever it is. I still think publishers are continually disconnecting themselves from their readership, and they're not taking what they've accomplished with their own publicity department and figuring out a way to, you know, get it out there digitally and make it work coming from them. They're still relying on third parties digitally to help them figure out how to reach audiences on the web. And, you know, I don't know if it's because of brand issues or resources or whatever it is, but you still see it time and time again. That's why you see all these companies constantly reaching out to publishers saying, we can help you reach your audiences, as opposed to publishers having figured out how to really engage directly with their audiences and using digital to do so. I don't mean to talk in absolutes.
Right, because not every publisher failed to engage readers. But it is true in general, it is safe to observe that many publishers have had trouble figuring out how to engage with real consumers, because they've been disconnected from consumers by the supply chain, essentially. And it's really difficult when you're not a consumer in the consumer business to know how to talk to consumers. It's really hard.
Right. And maybe publishers traditionally were just so used to always having that bookseller kind of be the bridge between their product and the reader. But I think we all thought that the promise of the web was going to be that now publishers would be able to directly engage with their readers. But let's face it, where that's probably still happening is through like Goodreads and things like that. It's a third party. It's Amazon because they own it, right? And so it's always these other entities that somehow are the bridge between the publisher and the audience. Sometimes we do see a publisher who's figured out a way to directly communicate, but it's few and far between. And, I just think that thinking in terms of what's possible online seems to have dissipated. And that's why the excitement of of the digital conferences at BEA or even Digital Book World seems to have really died down, right? That feeling that this is going to revolutionize the industry and really make a huge difference, I think people just feel like it's plateaued, mm-hmm. or that they just don't want to invest resources that
no, I think it's plateaued, and it's been digital has been integrated into the business in a way that wasn't true before. So it's no longer a new thing that has to be understood.
Right.
It actually is an understood thing, not necessarily fully advantaged, but it's not new anymore.
Well, it's interesting. It's become integrated for sure. But without naming names, I think, you know, it's been disheartening to see over the years that a lot of the people, including myself, who have been the champions of that integration and of kind of helping publishers understand the possibilities, and whether it's creatively or technically or whatever, a lot of those people have been pushed out,
right,
of the industry. And they, you know, are having a hard time now reintegrating into the publishing industry and trying to find ways to reinvent themselves, including me. And so it's kind of interesting where it's almost like there was this group of people that helped publishers get to a certain point, and then they were kind of shown the door. It was like, well, thank you right. very much for all your hard work. We'll take it from here.
Exactly.
But when was the last time you really heard something that made you say, oh, that's really interesting. That's really cool. That's really innovative coming from a publisher.
Well, there probably are some examples. I'm going to save those for another show.
I'm sure there are.
I want to thank you, Peter, for doing this with me. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I've been talking to Peter Costanzo, a longtime member of the publishing industry. Thanks for doing this, Peter.
Thank you, David. It's always fun talking to you about this stuff. Thanks. I appreciate it.